and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the government of Ecuador yesterday reinstated internet connectivity for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who has been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for the past 6 years. Assange had his internet and visitors cut off in March after he allegedly commented on Spanish elections in violation of an agreement with the Ecuadorians. Next, the international investigation into the disappearance and apparent murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi continues. Turkish authorities say they are positive that Khashoggi was tortured, murdered, and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and they have the video to prove it. Meanwhile, dozens of major business leaders are withdrawing from an upcoming business conference in Saudi Arabia. It's being called Davos in the Desert, in protest of the murder. Then, political observers are calling this weekend's elections in the southern German state of Bavaria a political earthquake, as Chancellor Angela Merkel's coalition partners were walloped, while the Green Party and the far-right Alternative for Germany increased their share of the vote dramatically. In fact, the Social Democratic Party, one of the coalition partners, garnered fewer votes than the neo-Nazis did. And then the Trump administration has ordered an obscure government agency, the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigations Board, to gut environmental regulations related to chemical and oil pipeline safety. Instead of mandatory regulations designed to keep workers and the public safe, those regulations will become voluntary suggestions. And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to Julian Assange. The government of Ecuador yesterday reinstated internet connectivity for the WikiLeaks founder, who has been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for the past 6 years. Assange had his internet and visitors cut off in March after he allegedly commented on Spanish elections in violation of an agreement with the Ecuadorians. We're joined from New York by Randy Credico. Randy's an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Randy, it's good to have you.
Hey, it's always a thrill to do your show. It really is.
You didn't sound thrilled.
Well, I'm very happy. I haven't been doing much media the last couple of weeks, but, you know, I always find time to do your show.
Thank you very much for that.
Because I enjoy, because you guys have a great sense of humor, and you're both serious individuals who've got stellar paths. So I appreciate your work as activists and as radio personality.
Why, thank you very much.
Thank you, Randy Credico.
Randy, I want to ask you, first of all, this is great news that Julian Assange has some internet connectivity back. But in every article that I saw about it this morning, it said that he was granted limited connectivity. Do you have any idea what that means?
I think what it means, first of all, the latest that I saw, and I'm just following because I'm not a spokesperson for Assange or for WikiLeaks. I'm an activist like you are. Just have been in the embassy a few times. It's been almost a year since I was last there. I think what it means is that he's got to be careful what he comments on, like, maybe Catalan again, maybe not even to deal with what's going on with Saudi Arabia. We know that he right now would be commenting, nonstop and exposing, the situation in Yemen. In fact, that's exactly the time when they cut him off. Everyone connects it to Catalan, but it was that time when Mohammed bin Salman was floating around from Paris to see Macron and London to see May and the U.S. to see Trump. And then that was just prior to the bombing of Syria that he advocated for. And he was commenting on that and the whole Skripal connection, all of that, and the sarin attack. So he's been cut off since then. So we don't know for sure what the reason was. I'm sure that the Brits didn't want him to be talking about that. So, and I'm sure they don't want him to be talking about this at all. Anything that relates to British interests, their war interests, U.S. interests. And Spain, I think, is really a diversion. It's a red herring. That's my assessment. That being said, he is limited. But when I looked this morning, he still hasn't had his internet turned on last couple of hours that I last looked, that he still has not. So we don't know, even if he has limited access yet. I haven't seen anything by him. And I don't know. I think eventually, maybe later today, he'll have it. But to limit a journalist, that's like letting a guy who's a baseball player, you know, out of the bullpen, but he can't pitch, you know? I mean, the star reliever, since we're in playoff mode right now, the star reliever, they take him out of the bullpen, but he can't pitch. You know, that's what they're doing.
Right. Yeah, I was surprised that this move apparently came as a result of a conversation with President Moreno with the UN Secretary General. I just sort of had the feeling that Moreno had made up his mind, that things were devolving. They weren't going well for Julian. And then there was this. And so perhaps what everybody's been saying over the past couple of weeks, that the government of Ecuador has made up its mind to expel Julian from the embassy, is just not true.
I think you're right, John. I think that, there's been a growing movement, you know, around the world. Assange, since he went in 6 months ago, it's backfired for the powers that be, because he's just gone up in stature. He's gone up. He's become this martyr-like figure. He's in conditions. Now, I was there last November 6th and 13th, and I want to tell you something. It's cramped quarters. It's like being at two toll booths back-to-back. The little rooms that he has gets no sunlight. Now, it's not the same conditions that you went through when you were in prison. I understand that my father was in prison. It's not like that. But, you know, to not be able to get any sunlight, not to be able to get any exercise, not being able to participate in your craft, and he hasn't done anything wrong. I mean, so he's there in a Kafka-esque situation, and he's unable to get, you know, humane treatment at all, and he has done nothing wrong. And as far as Moreno goes, I think that this is backfiring. There's been pressure at this point. He's Hamlet, you know, in the Gulf or whatever, that he can't decide what to do right now. He will be seen as, he will go down in history as a Somoza or as a Trujillo, any one of these banana republic leaders, a Batista, if in fact he were to accede to the U.S. or to the Brits and hand him over. So he's got the pressure from the U.S., but he's also got some kind of moral pressure on him at this point. So he's given a little, but it's still not enough. But I think that Assange being silent for 6 months right now, we've missed so much information that he could have been providing us in these foggy days where we're not getting documents out there. We're not getting stuff like the Panama Papers and things of that nature, cables. They'd be very useful for you and for other journalists to be able to have access to what is behind the scenes of what's happening in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, and all of that. We don't have access to it.
Brian, you've got a lot of experience over the years in Latin America. What does President Moreno have to do to walk that line between developing his country and becoming a pawn of the United States? How does he thread that needle and then at the same time deal with Julian Assange?
Well, you know, it's a question that often gets posed, and basically Moreno has to take responsibility for his own decisions. Yes, he's under a lot of pressure from the United States. Like, what government in Latin America that seeks to be independent isn't? He doesn't have to do what the United States dictates. He doesn't have to do what his more right-wing backers dictate. I mean, after all, he was the political protege, in a way, of the president who came before him. And what's happened now? I mean, look at what has actually gone down politically. Moreno is moving the country to the right. I mean, Ecuador's got a lot of progressive people in it. They want progressive change. They became a real leadership in the last 10 or 15 years. Does Moreno really want to sacrifice that sort of enhanced role that Ecuador played regionally and, in fact, globally in order to kowtow to the right wing and to America? I just don't get it.
Yes, well, good point. I mean, but you got to take a look at our policy in the last 4 or 5 years in Latin America of new engagement. Argentina is now doing joint exercises with the U.S. They have a right-wing leader there, Macri. You know, outside of Bolivia, you know, everything seems to be turning to the right. Colombia's got a reactionary president, only Mexico, of course. But in South America, you see these countries all drifting to the right. There's this pressure on Venezuela. They want everybody involved in it somehow. And it's, of course, we know it's all about oil in Venezuela. And so, you know, everybody, the U.S. is trying to round up the troops down there and help them solve a headache for the U.S. A headache is not having complete access to that oil that Venezuela has and put in a puppet government. So, you know, it's a small country, Ecuador, but, you know, look, they stood out in the world. They're the ones that gave this gentleman, Assange, who is a journalist, he's being chased, as journalists were during the French Revolution throughout Paris, by Lafayette, who was working for the king. That's what's happening here. They want to just quiet him. And, you know, just take a look at Khashoggi. I mean, you know, that he went into that embassy and he got killed. They want to do the same thing to him. Not that Khashoggi is anywhere near what Assange is. Assange is a real, you know, I mean, he's a journalist that without allegiance, he's a journalist that just takes a look and he tells it like it is. And so let the chips fall where they may. And he's a danger. He's a danger to the power structure. And getting back to South America, you see this big shift back towards, you know, neoliberalism and kowtowing to the U.S. It had dissipated, you know, when in Venezuela, in those Bolivarian alliances, it had dissipated. I think Uruguay is still okay, but look at Brazil. Look at Brazil. So they're all like drifting. It looks like the 60s Operation Condor all over again.
It does. Randy, we have 30 seconds left. The thing that I want to end with is this, and I want you to finish out. It's so important to keep visibility for the case of Julian Assange because he's holed up there. They cut off his internet for a long time. If we start to not pay attention, that's the worst thing. What we're doing, what you're doing, what other activists are doing is the most important thing, which is to keep the visibility of Julian Assange's case front and center. 30 seconds left.
Exactly. I think everybody that's been involved, whether it be some kind of divisions, whatever, everybody's got to be involved and put the pedal to the metal here. Everybody got to be vigilant. They should not recede in their enthusiasm and alacrity. Everybody's got to do from whatever corner they can do it from. And even though he was given this little bit of light, he has to have complete access. He's got to be free. And we should not take this as just a victory and spike the ball. We have a long way to go still, and we must maintain our enthusiasm and activism until he is totally extricated from this horrible situation that he's in.
Agreed. That was the voice of Randy Credico, who joined us from New York. Randy's a well-known activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The international investigation into the disappearance and apparent murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi continues. Turkish authorities say they are positive that Khashoggi was tortured, murdered, and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and they have the video to prove it. Meanwhile, dozens of major business leaders are withdrawing from an upcoming business conference in Saudi Arabia, that's being called Davos in the Desert, in protest of the murder. We're joined here in the studio by Mansour Al-Haj. He's a journalist, author, and a member of the board of directors of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. Welcome.
Thank you.
I was struck by a very powerful and strong editorial in the Washington Post over the weekend, where the editor of the editorial board, Fred Hyatt, who's known as a conservative here in Washington, asked, "Why do you work for a murderer?" So this question was posed to those Americans who have retired from the intelligence community, they've retired from the diplomatic community or the military community, and they've gone to work for the Saudi government. They've gone to work as advisors or lobbyists or what have you. There are a lot of Washingtonians who are on the Saudi payroll. Do you think that this apparent murder of Jamal Khashoggi is going to change that in any way? Are fewer Americans going to be willing to take that risk and work for a murderer?
I hope so, but I personally don't think so. We unfortunately live in a time or in a world where people want to make money and have easy access to wealth as fast as possible. For now, Saudi Arabia has been providing that. Saudi Arabia has been spending millions, billions of dollars in Western cities and sadly employing people who are people with deep knowledge and understanding of the U.S. Policies and politics and even in our intelligence community. I don't see the Khashoggi case. I don't think it would change anything regarding that. People think if they do the job, they deserve the earning, regardless who is paying. And this is unfortunate. This is something that is making my work and the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia very difficult. The influence is not only on retired people. We still see some influence even within the administration. If you see or if you listen to President Trump's statement regarding arms deal and his relationship with the Saudis, you will see that the economic interests comes before human rights. So if people see that their country, that I mean the United States, that should be championing, defending human rights and freedom of expression and standing against oppression and authoritarian regimes in the world, dealing and being very soft with a regime that is as brutal as the Saudi regime, they would think it's okay for them also to work with the people or the government, the Saudi government.
You were born and raised in Saudi Arabia. You've spent much of your adult life engaged in activism for human rights. Tell us about human rights in Saudi Arabia. I read just this morning that so far 43 people have been beheaded in the last 2 months for a variety of crimes, things like witchcraft or fornication, and that indeed there's a woman on death row now who is going to be beheaded only because she has been active in agitating for women's rights in Saudi Arabia. These are not capital cases, or at least they're not supposed to be. The prisons in Saudi Arabia right now are full of bloggers and writers and journalists and poets and people who in some way may have offended Mohammed bin Salman. So is that the future of Saudi Arabia? That if you say anything at all that Mohammed bin Salman does not like, that you end up in prison?
Sadly, this is the trend right now. I have so many friends who are in jail right now, just not only because they said something. One of my friends, he did not even say anything. He was in prison just based on his affiliation with HASM, which is a human rights organization. Most of its members are in jail right now.
And what happens then? Do they go on trial? Are they charged with a crime?
Even if they do that, everything is said.
It's
even because you don't have a system in Saudi Arabia. The legislative branch is totally ruled and managed by the executive branch, and also the judiciary is all, you know, people, judges get appointed by the king and the royal family. So you don't have independence, you don't have anything that would provide fair trial for these people. The human rights violations of Saudi Arabia are very well documented in the UN, and most human rights organizations keep records of all these violations, every single person who has been arrested or in jail are most likely going to be on list of human rights organizations. People know the level of oppression that is going on in Saudi Arabia. Most people know that. In Saudi press, you don't see a single word against Mohammed bin Salman and his new policies. For women rights activists, those who have campaigned for women rights and for rights for women to drive are in jail
now. Yes.
One of them actually was arrested in the United Arab Emirates and was taken back to Saudi Arabia. We have seen, I mean, Jamal Khashoggi's case, even though we don't know for sure, like with concrete evidence, what happened, but it's not unprecedented. I mean, we have seen Saudi Arabia killing Nasser al-Said in 1979 in Lebanon. He was kidnapped, taken back to Saudi Arabia and was killed. We have seen princes disappearing from Europe.
And princesses.
And princesses fleeing Saudi Arabia. We have seen a wave now that I'm really hopeful and optimistic for, that the people, especially those who are on scholarships in the United States and Canada and Australia, hundreds of them are deciding to stay where they are. The situation in Saudi Arabia is unbearable, not even for the ones who are just minding their own business, but even if you don't express support for the Crown Prince, you will be imprisoned. You will be charged with things that people really don't understand why. So I'm really saddened, but at the same time, I'm hopeful that, you know, these atrocities and crimes be investigated, and the free world where I really feel safe to live in. This is exactly why I'm doing this, because I have experienced it. A lot of my friends are going through it right now, and I do it. And I have myself received death threats and a number of threats for doing basic things, just defending human rights in Saudi Arabia.
When Mohammed bin Salman came to power, when he became crown prince, it was because he essentially overthrew his cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef. Besides overthrowing Mohammed bin Nayef, he arrested Mohammed bin Nayef and dozens of other princes. Essentially, anyone who might pose a threat to him, they were either held at the Ritz-Carlton, sent to prison, sent into exile. They had to pay these enormous fines, and now you don't hear anything about them. Is there anybody in the wake of this Khashoggi thing, is there anybody inside Saudi Arabia who can challenge Mohammed bin Salman? We have about a minute left.
I don't think so. Internally, Mohammed bin Salman is in full control of everything that is going on in Saudi Arabia. People now, some people at least, are betting on Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, who had expressed some criticism for the ongoing policies and ongoing problems inside Saudi Arabia and outside the Hisar of Qatar, the siege on Qatar and the war in Yemen and everything that is going on in Saudi Arabia. Internally, sadly, King Salman put everything in the hand of Mohammed bin Salman.
Literally everything.
Everything. And even with the documented deterioration of every aspect of life in Saudi Arabia, internally and outside, you can see journalists expressing, you know, their support for this young prince that is really taking Saudi Arabia to its demise, I believe.
Dark days are ahead for Saudi Arabia. We were joined here in the studio by Mansour Al-Haj. He is a journalist, author, and a member of the board of directors of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Political observers are calling this weekend's elections in the southern German state of Bavaria, quote, a political earthquake, unquote, as Chancellor Angela Merkel's coalition partners were walloped
while the Green Party and the far-right Alternative for Germany increased their share of the vote dramatically. In fact, the Social Democratic Party, one of the coalition partners, garnered fewer votes than the neo-Nazis did. We're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, Walter.
Happy to be here.
Walter, walloped really is the word. I'm looking at the final tallies. The Social Democratic Party, which is nationally a small party for Germany, but important enough that it's always in the coalition. And just by tradition, the SDP's leader is always the German foreign minister. They went from 42 seats to 22 seats. They were just crushed. And they came in pretty well behind, half of a percentage point, which in the greater scheme of things is a lot of votes, behind the neo-Nazis. Similarly, the Christian Social Union, which is the primary coalition partner in Bavaria for Angela Merkel's party, lost 16 votes. Now, it still has 85, but that's 85 out of a total of 205 seats. What happens next?
Right. This is, I think, very, very important for German national politics. You know, it's not just regional in scope. I mean, really, it's not even just national. It has big implications for the rise of the far right across Europe. So the Christian Social Union, you know, Germany has kind of an interesting parliamentary structure. And so basically, the national center-right party is the CDU. That's the Christian Democratic Union. That's the party of Chancellor Angela Merkel. But in the state of Bavaria, which is a very large and important state, the CDU doesn't run there. And instead, they have what's effectively like a sister party, which is the CSU, the Christian Social Union. And so the CSU, their position is, they basically cut out a position that is a little bit to the right of the CDU, Angela Merkel's party, on the issue of migration and refugees coming into Germany. And in fact, at the national level, the leader of the CSU, Horst Seehofer, almost brought down the coalition government that supports Angela Merkel's leadership because he demanded what he called a plan of action to deal with a refugee crisis, basically demanding that the government implement a number of anti-refugee measures. And so their strategy in the Bavarian state election was to more or less pander to the far right, which is the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party. And so that didn't work out very well for them, right? They lost about 10% of their vote share. The AfD got about 10% of the vote, right? There is still this transfer, and that's, you know, those levels of support are pretty much in line with national polls, but it was a big blow for them in terms of their, standing in Bavaria, you know, the state that's their bastion.
It is. That's where they traditionally have been the strongest and really have not been challenged there in many decades. I mean, this really is a big deal, at least in Bavaria. Now, Angela Merkel has to be nervous now. She has a very fragile coalition in Berlin. Although this election is regional and doesn't directly affect what's happening in Berlin, it certainly does indirectly. So what we've seen, it looks like at least, is the far right surging because of the immigrant crisis, as you just mentioned. But the far left also is surging. Now, in Bavaria, the Greens did very well, but the left party actually didn't. In Berlin, the left party has done well, and the left party is represented in parliament. So there are far more leftists now than there are rightists and far rightists, or at least far rightists. It seems to me that despite the fact that the far right and the neo-Nazis have gotten a lot of press lately by beating up refugees or invading refugee encampments or giving speeches saying that they want to expel refugees, it's actually the left that has done better. How do you account for that?
In certain circumstances, I agree with that. I think that's true. I mean, the left party is always historically weak in Bavaria. They didn't make it into parliament. They didn't pass I think it's a 5% threshold.
Right. So they couldn't make it in Bavaria.
Yeah. And, you know, the Social Democrats, just to go back to what you were mentioning in the previous question, you know, I think it really is historically significant that the Social Democratic Party came in fifth place, right? I mean, that's, you
crazy.
Know, yeah, historically, it's the biggest party in Germany. I mean, for like the entirety of the 20th century,
yeah.
Pretty much. So, but yeah, I mean, the Greens, right, so that was the other party in addition to the AfD that managed to substantially increase their vote share in Bavaria. And, you know, they may be able to pull off something similar at a national level. And the Greens, I think, unlike the Social Democrats, are clear in what their position is. I mean, they you know, support equal rights and dignity for refugees. They believe in, you know, relatively open borders and conforming with international law. And so I think that when voters are, you know, given a clear choice, right, they're going to go with the, you know, the position. You know, if you're a pro-immigrant, pro-refugee person, you're going to vote for the party that actually clearly states that rather than sort of trying to be all things to all people. So I think that's why the Greens did well. The left party, there's some divisions within the left party in Germany about how to deal with this. There's, you know, the traditional position of the left party, which is, you know, very much pro-refugee. There's another wing that basically it's around. There's this new movement that's been launched called Stand Up. And basically it's by members of the left party who are still members of the left party, but want to have this sort of other political vehicle, kind of like momentum and the Labour Party in Britain, to try to organize the voters who are in danger or have already been captured by the far right, sort of the former industrial workers, people who are, you know, really hurt by the economic policies of the last couple of decades. And, you know, their tack is quite different in terms of refugees. I mean, they're sort of, while not adopting sort of the xenophobic positions of the actual right wing in Germany, they're kind of playing up economic issues and sort of expressing maybe like sympathy with people who have some sort of anti-refugee sentiment. So there is a little bit of division there, but the Green Party, I think, you know, has sort of put forward this pretty unequivocal position.
Yeah, the Green Party in Germany was the first European Green Party to actually win seats in a national parliament, and they've really made something of themselves. The last time I was in Germany, I was asked to speak to members of the left in parliament. One of the things that struck me is they see themselves as future players. And so they want to be an all-inclusive, all-encompassing party. All they wanted to talk about was the U.S. military presence in Germany and the U.S. drone program in Germany. So rather than focusing just on, let's say, immigration or employment, they're looking to expand because they see an alliance with the Greens in their future, and they see long-term representation in the German parliament for themselves. I also wanted to ask you about an anti-racism protest that took place over the weekend. It wasn't terribly well publicized in Germany, but it still ended up with about, well, the BBC says with more than 100,000 people participating. There's a photo that Getty Images supplied that's running the BBC, and it shows, it looks like a heck of a lot more than 100,000 people to me. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, right. Organizers said that it was more like 250,000, and
that looks correct.
Yeah, it's truly a massive outpouring of opposition to the rise of the far right. I mean, you know, I think the way that politics in Germany and other countries that see a resurgent far right is the coverage of it is kind of lacking, right? In the sense that the most sensational thing, of course, are, you know, the relatively small sector of the population that's, you know, running amok in the streets, speeding up immigrants and things like that. But, you know, there's also a very, very strong progressive current in German society. And it was on full display in Germany, in Berlin this weekend with this massive demonstration. It was called the Indivisible Demonstration. I think the slogan that was raised was solidarity instead of exclusion. And there were a very wide range of different organizations, both, you know, political in nature or like constituency or issue based. It was a broad coalition that put together the action. The left party was very visible there with their banners and flags. And so I think that type of current, the sort of backlash to the rise of the AfD, and there are actually forces to the right of the AfD that exists in German politics as well. There is, I think, substantial opposition to that that's more and more willing to become mobilized.
Well, I think that's exactly right. This BBC piece had a couple of very interesting quotes. First of all, it says that even the event's organizers were surprised by the turnout. They went on to say that people don't go to demonstrations because they're bored and they have nothing else to do. They go to demonstrations because they believe in things like defending human rights and in racial and ethnic tolerance. There's a quote from an anonymous marcher in this demonstration, and I think it really encapsulates it. She says, "There are so many people who believe they can abuse human rights and questions of equality and so on, and it's time to just say no. There are other people who just want to be open and open-minded." The Germans proved that, I think, by taking to the streets.
I would agree with that for sure, and we'll have to see how That develops. We'll have to see how these efforts to win over the sections of the population that are vulnerable to far-right propaganda goes. And, you know, we'll also have to see how international and geopolitical developments unfold as the European Union enters rocky territory.
That was Walter Smolarek. Walter is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
3 days after a Sunoco pipeline in Texas caught fire during welding work in 2016, a tiny government agency called the U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board dispatched a team to investigate. The team originally drafted a report recommending mandatory safety changes for any company that does pipeline welding. But earlier this year, agency leadership removed the regulatory recommendation and told the research team instead to recommend voluntary changes to Sunoco. We're joined from New York by Scott Edwards, co-director of the Food and Water Justice Program at Food and Water Watch. Scott, it's good to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, but making regulatory suggestions rather than regulatory changes or demands essentially just guts the whole program, no?
Yeah, I mean, this program has always existed as sort of this almost an advisory board, which though, you know, in the past, some folks have credited to making good protective recommendations to agencies that can pass regulations. And there's been some degree of deference to them, even though they really don't have any teeth at the end of the day. I mean, they do go out, they do investigations, they have a staff that's been dedicated to investigating these things and making these recommendations in the past. But even that minor role is being gutted these days under this administration.
So what happens then? Obviously, the EPA isn't going to get involved. This small agency, this Chemical Safety Board, is on the wrong side of the issue. So for the remainder of the Trump presidency, we just have to accept the fact that the likes of Sunoco are going to be able to do whatever they want to the environment? Is it that ugly a reality?
Oh, yeah, it's probably uglier than that. Sunoco will do whatever it is they want, as will ExxonMobil and the rest of the fossil fuel, the oil and gas industry. And if there's something on the books that they don't like, they will go out and get it removed from the books, even if it's at EPA or any of the other agencies. You know, this administration has shown time and time again, and they're currently doing it, that its number one priority is to allow the oil and gas industry to do whatever they want, however they want it, and no regard to safety, environmental concerns, climate change, economics, anything. They're running the show.
That's the voice of Scott Edwards. We're talking to Scott from New York. Scott is the co-director of the Food and Water Justice Project of Food and Water Watch. I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal article that came out yesterday about this issue. There's a picture of these boats out in the Gulf of Mexico, and they're using water cannons to try to put out the fire from the BP disaster in 2010. Here's the subtitle. The U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board investigates incidents ranging from the chemical plant accidents to oil spills, such as the one caused by the deadly 2010 explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig off of Louisiana. You know, Scott, when you think about it, like, everybody was riveted to what happened with that explosion. I mean, we had oil pouring nonstop 24/7 for weeks and weeks and months actually into the Gulf of Mexico, destroying sea life, destroying the environment, destroying businesses that were associated with it, destroying beachfront properties, swamplands. It was such a big deal. I mean, here we are just 8 years later, and even this like weak regulatory investigative agency is now being, well, it was already toothless is what you're saying, but now instead of being defanged, I guess its lips are just being sewn shut by the Trump administration. And you would think this would like cause more outrage. What do you think?
It does cause outrage among too few people, and it's the people who pay attention to these things, who track what this administration is doing. I mean, part of the problem with this administration is it does so many outrageous things on so many different fronts, it's hard for everybody to keep up. And so when you look at things like oil and gas pipeline safety issues, they're easy to fall by the wayside. And you also got this insane news cycle. So 8 years ago is...
It's 80 years ago. It feels like 80 years ago.
Seriously. Well, look what happened in the suburbs of Boston just weeks ago, right? A pipeline explosion, 38 buildings or tens of buildings destroyed. California, 38 buildings, 8 people killed in 2010 from natural gas pipelines. I mean, we are in a country that is now pursuing natural gas and fossil fuel infrastructure build out at a rate that will bring safety concerns, that will bring sloppy workmanship. There is a rush under this administration, and these companies know it, right? They see this is the gold rush for them, right? They have an administration that is literally destroying all safeguards, any kind of assessment, safety, environmental assessments, and has opened the gates and allowed all of this to happen, more drilling, more infrastructure. We've got almost 2.5 million miles of pipelines in this country, crisscrossing this country. Half of them were in place before 1970. So we're talking about pipelines that are almost 50 years old, and they are pumping more high-pressure gas, more oil through these aging, old pipelines, and we're going to see all kinds of accidents, explosions. And we've got laws that say that these pipelines only need to be inspected once every 7 years in this country. So what we're seeing right now is just an all-out, just free-for-all in oil and gas development and a withdrawal of safety, environmental, public health.
Most Americans have never heard of this tiny little agency, but its importance really is outsized. This agency recommends regulations. It doesn't make its own regulations, but it recommends regulations to the EPA, as Scott just said, usually having to do with safety. Well, if you only have to inspect a pipeline once every 7 years, and then even that is modified or lifted, of course you're going to have explosions and leaks and deaths and property damage and all kinds of terrible things. It says here in the Wall Street Journal article today, in the Wall Street Journal, says that Trump has twice sought to abolish the entire thing. This is the Chemical Safety Board, saying that there are enough regulations already, that in fact, instead of new regulations or new recommendations for regulations, we need to do away with the entire organization so that there are no recommendations.
I think, and Scott, I want to get your opinion on this, because you are an advocacy organization. You're trying to educate the public. Obviously, ultimately, these are political decisions and policy decisions. It seems to me that, there are 62 million people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Maybe that same number of people will vote for him again. I think his chances of re-election are fairly strong, actually. Who knows? We'll see. There's a lot of time. But one thing is that the people who oppose Donald Trump's sort of posture here are not significantly reaching working class communities in the so-called red states. And I think they can be reached, but we have to emphasize issues like these pipelines that are crisscrossing the country, for instance, not only them, but if something happens to these pipelines, or if something is happening to them, it's going to impact negatively the same people who may feel politically conservative or close to Donald Trump for this, that, or the other reason. But nonetheless, his policies are actually detrimental to them. He is, in fact, the enemy of their communities.
Oh, it's a hugely important point you're making. I mean, about voting, talk about voting against one's interests, and just related to this, but a little bit outside the scope is these incidents, right, the 230 explosions between 2010 and 2016, pipeline explosions in this country, this is the result of this rush to continue and expand our oil and gas production. But if you want to talk about voting against one interest, even, they're building this infrastructure in states that very much went Donald Trump's way. But I'll give you a more extreme example tied into the oil and gas and the expansion of this industry is climate change. And it is no doubt that all this oil and gas infrastructure build out being sloppily done these days is creating more leaks, more methane leaks, more climate problems, creating more severe storms like Florence that just literally drown North Carolina. And yet North Carolina voters have two climate deniers sitting in the Senate, two Republican climate deniers. And so we see this all the time, people voting against their interests. Your house is 4 feet underwater because of a climate-fueled storm, and you're putting two senators in office who are climate deniers, and you vote a president who thinks it's a Chinese hoax. And so these are, you're absolutely right, these are the kind of messages we need to get out to Trump supporters, that this man is not overseeing this government with your interests at heart in any, and that's just one example, right? Then we reel off a dozen of every facet of one's life and on how he is not here to benefit the very people who put him in office.
Yeah, that was the voice of Scott Edwards. He joined us from New York. Scott is the co-director of the Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks so much. Good to hear your voice.
Bill, there's so much to talk about today, but I know that you want to start with the Laquan McDonald case in Chicago, and specifically about how educators deal with terrible events like this, and with the organizations that are involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a case study in a way. I mean, but what happened, just for people who aren't up to date on this, is that Laquan McDonald was a young man, 15 years old, struggling with homelessness and mental health issues. And he was confronted on the South Side in the middle of the night, carrying a small knife in which he was apparently puncturing car tires. Four police cars followed him for a couple of blocks. And then, out of the blue, one cop car pulls up suddenly. An officer jumps out and shoots Laquan McDonald 16 times. And what happened in the aftermath is absolutely typical, which is to say that everybody turned the page. The media reported it as a threatening, you know, the police officer felt that his life was in danger. You know, the story's already been written so many times that all you need to do is add a date and a name, and it becomes the same old story. I saw it on the news that night, and the story was that a threatening kid had approached a cop with a knife, and the cop defended himself. When some very important investigative reporters got a hold of this, they got an anonymous tip from an insider, and they got the autopsy, and the young man had been shot 16 times, mostly in the back, and the video that came out was absolutely condemning. But the most important thing, and the thing that's often lost in the story, is there was a social movement on the ground, Black Lives Matter, Black Youth Project 100, and these folks were mobilized. And when the mayor suppressed the video, the state's attorney suppressed the video, the chief of police suppressed the video, but when the video came out, all hell broke loose. And we just finished last week the trial of Jason Van Dyke, the officer who shot him. He was convicted, to everyone's surprise, of second-degree murder. The reason it was a surprise is there have been 400 police killings in the last few decades. This is the first time that an officer, an on-duty officer, was charged with murder for killing an African-American person. That's astonishing in itself. The jury had one black juror, the rest not black, white, and I think there was an Asian person. But everyone was surprised that the verdict turned out the way it did. Now, the question that was raised for educators is, how do you deal with this with kids? And, of course, the city was ready for a not guilty verdict, and so they had canceled all high school football games. They had kind of locked the city down. But the verdict was not, I wouldn't call it justice, but I would say it was a step in the right direction. And so teachers of good conscience and the teachers union have been very busy following up on something that already exists in Chicago, which is a curriculum about police misconduct, which was ordered into the school system with an agreement that was made after the John Burge torture trials. Now, I'm getting into the weeds a little bit, and I don't want to distract people, but we already have a curriculum to be taught in the high schools about a police officer who was part of a ring of people who tortured young black men on the South Side into confessing to crimes they didn't commit. So this curriculum already exists. A new book just came out by Ronald Kitchen called My Midnight Years, as one of the victims of that that torture regime that existed in Chicago some 10, 20 years ago. And Ronald's book is now being taught in the Chicago public schools. So there's a lot happening. But as usual, the problem is, the challenge to teachers is, how do we connect to kids in real time, in real life, with the real issues that impact them? Not some abstract, you know, long ago, far away, but this is something right in front of us. It's a way to understand both history, culture, sociology, psychology, and learning to read. So very excited that this verdict came in, and very admiring of the teachers who are using it as a teachable moment.
It's one thing, Bill, that I think isn't discussed, and I'm glad we're talking about this right now, is that the reality of Laquan McDonald and all of the other students, especially young black students or young black and Latino students in urban environments, there's this range of problems. There's especially the terror, the fear of police, then the knowledge that the police could come in and do something like what they did to Laquan McDonald. They could do it to you, to another young
That's
person.
Right.
And so there's this there's this reality, this overarching reality. And it's a completely different reality from what especially white kids in suburban or middle class or upper middle class environments face. And the people who don't face it don't know about it. They don't even think about it in the main. Not, it doesn't mean all people. And it's not simply an act of racism. It's just people are like in a shepherded bubble environment, so they don't realize it. But it's hard to overstate, I think, what the impact that has on kids psychologically in terms of the way they're perceiving the world as they're growing up.
No doubt. I mean, the feeling of being vulnerable, the feeling of being disposable is a very, very much present in the lives of kids. And it's something that impacts their ability to focus in school, their ability to come in with a clear head, their ability to learn. And if they look at the authorities as dangerous rather than as working in their behalf. Now, one of the things that's happened in Chicago, and you may have heard of this, is that the mayor who closed 50 schools on the west side of Chicago is now proposing to build a $95 million police academy. So if there's ever been a recipe for social suicide, this is it. Close schools, open a cop academy. And then we have in Chicago a wonderful political movement called hashtag No Cop Academy, in which people are saying, we need schools, we need mental health clinics, we need drug treatment, we need the police to be disarmed, we need a lot of things, but what we don't need is a police academy while you're closing off access to education.
Bill Ayers is our guest. We talk to Bill every Monday in this segment called Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers. Bill, we have about 3.5 minutes left. I'm looking at today's New York Times. Amazing, shocking, disgusting headline. Homeless in New York public schools at a record high. 114,659 students. One out of every 10 students are homeless in New York City public schools. I'll read the first sentence. Tonight, about one out of every 10 students in New York City will sleep in a homeless shelter or in the homes of relatives. That's more children than at any other time since city records have been kept. In the morning, those same children will fan out across the city to go to school, some crossing multiple boroughs to get there. Multiple boroughs means you're going from Queens or Bronx or Staten Island to New York or vice versa or to the Bronx. Long trips. Amazing. The richest country of the world, so-called. Here in New York City, perhaps the jewel of New York, of the United States. One out of every 10 kids homeless while going to school. And this is in the middle of an economic boom. In other words, we're not in a great recession, just the opposite. The stock market is booming. Says a lot. And at the same time, when I read these numbers out to our editorial meeting, John, this morning.
Yeah, it was shocking.
I asked people, how many homeless kids do you think there are in New York City schools? The high number was 10,000.
Yeah. And I would have said a handful.
It's 114,000, one out of every 10. Go ahead.
That is just a staggering statistic. And it's also borne out by anyone who lives in this country can go to certain parts of the city. In Chicago, I can go under the freeway and find a thriving hobo community, a homeless community. And this is true all over the country. Go to Oakland, San Francisco, Baltimore. I mean, it is a shame of the nation. And the fact that the school reformers, the people like Bill Gates and Michael Bloomberg and Arne Duncan and Betsy DeVos, the fact that they keep focusing on number one, test scores, and number two, what they call accountability, never includes accountability for the government or the city or the state to take care of the fact of homelessness and hunger. Kids come to school hungry. How can you expect them to have even a slight chance of focusing on what they need to focus on if they're hungry and homeless and fearful for their lives? This is the world we've built. This is the world we have to change, and we can change.
Yeah. I'm so glad he said that. It's not about standardized testing. If these kids, I mean, these kids are homeless, and by the way, most of their parents are probably working. That's the other thing.
Without a doubt.
Every homeless adult I know in New York, this isn't true for all homeless adults, but the ones I know, they're all working and living in shelters.
Right. And here we have a couple other news stories to point to, and we'll get to them in the future. But one is Unite Here, organizing hotel workers, which are sweeping the country. It's in Boston today and Honolulu. But there have been huge strikes here in Chicago. And once again, these are working people who are asking for a very simple demand. One job should be enough. I should be able to be a housekeeper at the Hilton, make a living wage, send my kids to school, and retire with dignity. But we don't have that in this country, not at this point. That's one news item that we have to get to because it ties to all these other questions. The second is the lawsuit at Harvard, which you remember you had Kevin Kumashiro, my colleague and friend, on the show last summer. And Kevin has written a lot about this. This is a group of Asian Americans, in my view, in the kind of thrall or in the control of a right-wing group that's trying to do away with affirmative action, have sued Harvard University around admissions. The trial starts today. It's going to be important to watch. Kevin Kumashiro, my colleague, comrade, who you had on the show, has written eloquently about this and the ways in which white supremacists will use anything to undo any progress for black people. So this is worth talking about down the line.
We absolutely will. That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joined us from Chicago. He's a prominent activist, educator, and the author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his work at www.billayers.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.